I'm not sure I'm going to bring it up. It's about what to do if someone that has Ebola pulls up to your emergency department in their car. What do you do with the car?
I would have said, I don't care because I'm in marketing.
Welcome to Touchpoint, a podcast dedicated to discussions on digital marketing and digital patient engagement strategies for hospitals, health systems, and physician practices. In this podcast, we'll dive deep into a variety of topics on the digital tools, solutions, strategies, and processes that are impacting our industry today. We hope to share a lot of great information and have some fun along the way. I am Chris Boyer, and I'm always pleased to be joined by my co-host, Reed Smith, who's on the other side of the microphone. Reed is a digital marketing strategist, an expert in digital marketing technology, a social media enthusiast, and he also is pretty good with some leather and woodworking as well. Plus, he's an artist, I think. Anyway, you can find Reed online on most of the social media channels with his handle, at Reed Smith. He's really active on LinkedIn. I strongly recommend everybody follow him on LinkedIn. And his website is socialhealthinstitute.com. Reed, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, man. Of course, that is Chris Boyer, the other half of the podcast. And you can find him at ChristopherBoyer.com, at Chris Boyer on all the social channels. And a great person to connect with, especially as it relates to hospital marketing, digital marketing, social media, etc. All those kinds of fun topics that we talk about each week. This episode of Touchpoint is brought to you by one of our sponsors, Transparently.
Transparently is the nation's fastest growing platform for gathering and publishing physician star ratings and reviews. You can visit transparently.com to learn why the country's most innovative health systems are choosing them to power a better digital patient experience.
Again, to learn more, visit them online at transparently.com. Here we are, episode 34, talking a little bit about crisis communications, and specifically crisis communications as it relates to digital and how digital has changed things up a little bit in recent years.
And, you know, this is a topic that's top of mind to a lot of organizations lately, seeing, and particularly for you, Reed, being down in Texas, because recently right. There's been a lot of natural disaster crises that have occurred.
You know, our expert that we'll hear from later, Lance Lunsford from the Texas Hospital Association, obviously is very involved, being the state-level association here in Texas. Everything that's happened with Hurricane Harvey and all their member organizations that are down in that part of the state. But yeah, it is. You know, Texas is a big state. We continue to see things that have happened over the years, whether it be, you know, natural disasters or otherwise. And we'll talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, and in Florida too, and Puerto Rico. And of course, the news reports about a hospital maybe being impacted and what that means. And then you heard about the tragedy that happened at that nursing care facility in Florida. I mean, all of these things around crisis, it becomes really top of mind. But before we actually dive into that, maybe it would be good to talk about just crisis communication, give a high-level definition of what that might be, just so people can kind of understand, and maybe we could even define some of the different types of crises that might impact hospitals and health systems. What do you think?
Yep, let's do it.
Well, I looked up on Wikipedia, Reed, the definition for crisis communication, and I found it kind of interesting. We'll use that as maybe a starting point here. Let me quote it. The term crisis should be reserved for serious events that require careful attention from management. Crisis management has been defined as a set of factors designed to combat crises and to lessen the actual damages inflicted by the crisis. Crisis management should not merely be reactionary, it should also consist of preventative measures and preparation in advance, anticipation of potential crisis. And then lastly, they say, effective crisis management has a potential to greatly reduce the amount of damage the organization receives as a result of the crisis, and may even prevent an incident from ever developing into a crisis.
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is obviously not an if, but when kind of scenario. Something will happen at your hospital, and it's, are you prepared for it? And obviously, you know, the stuff we're talking about, at least we hope, is few and far between, whether it be natural disasters or some other, you know, big events that have happened around the country. So let's talk about a few of those and maybe kind of how those break down. So we've already mentioned natural disasters. Mm-hmm. And in recent memory, and probably what everybody's currently thinking about, is just even just the last few weeks. So you've got, you know, what happened with Hurricane Harvey. You've also got, you know, Irma that hit Florida. You've got now, is it Maria? Is that right?
Yeah,
that's on Maria. The kind of that's making making its way. You know, could potentially cause a lot of damage in Puerto Rico. You have those types of things. Obviously, there's a little bit more the ability to prepare, you know, for those. So you see the hurricane coming, you see it building, tropical storm, now it's a hurricane, etc. Mm-hmm. You're in those parts of the country where there is such thing as a hurricane season. So when we lived in Pensacola, that was always always a big thing there in Florida. But in addition, you've got things like earthquakes.
Yep.
You know, we just saw that happen. And, mm-hmm. and you know, we have those obviously in different parts of the country that are more susceptible to that. You're not watching it and it's like, okay, well, we think about Wednesday that this is going to happen. You know, there's none of that. It just all of a sudden it just happens randomly.
Other things could also be like health outbreaks. Also, I was in New York working when the Ebola scare occurred here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, and so how do you deal with health outbreaks? Ebola, or it could even be like measles. Which happened in Brooklyn. There's a lot of different types of things that could occur. You know, a really serious flu season. I remember a few years back when we didn't have the, you know, adequate flu shot, that it really impacted people in a negative way in some communities. Those are a little bit harder to predict. Maybe you can start to anticipate those and be ready for them, but sometimes those come out of nowhere.
Yeah, or you could time it by the release of a Jenny McCarthy book or something like that, I guess, maybe. But I kid, but not really. But yeah, so that's another one. So you've got natural disasters, you've got health outbreaks. Obviously, you have things, you know, more, you know, criminal, terrorist type slants. I mean, 9/11 obviously was probably the most, you know, visible and most impactful, quite honestly. But then, you know, you saw the shootings in Aurora, Colorado some years ago, the Oklahoma City bombings, you know, et cetera. So there's different things like that, that while they may not actually physically happen at your facility, obviously being a major healthcare provider for your region, your town, whatever it may be, you're going to be a big a focal point.
Yeah, particularly, you know, as you respond to that crisis and your organization is going to be in sort of the epicenter of how to respond to that. So those kinds of disasters, Reed, are things that are occurring outside, kind of bringing, you know, outside that may be impacting the organization, things that may be out of your control as an organization. But then there's this whole other series of crises that kind of fall under the same definition of crisis communication. And those are things that happen internally that kind of filter up. So like, for example, you may have like a physician that suddenly is in a scandal around a clinical malpractice suit, or, you know, maybe some kind of medical error that occurred that suddenly becomes a crisis now that you, from a PR perspective, that you have to kind of manage.
Yeah, you always see or hear, I say you always see, I don't guess you always see it, but you hear about, you know, the, oh, you know, I'm going to pick something that's pretty outlandish or pretty extreme, but, you know, okay, somebody amputated the wrong leg, you know, the wrong extremity or whatever, and, you know, those types of things. You've also got physicians that maybe it has nothing to do with their clinical practice, but something happened in more of like maybe it's their personal life or something like that was caused them to end up in the news. You know, I don't know. So you have those types of scenarios that, you know, you kind of get pulled into by proxy. You're where they practice medicine kind of a deal, especially if they have a title within the organization. And then you have, you know, your administrative folks. And we've seen that a time or two where, you know, they're running some scam, you know, or whatever it is, and have to resign. And, you know, now you've got that type of an issue.
And then you have things like maybe payer or contract negotiations. And it's interesting, as we're recording this, there is on Twitter right now, we've been observing over the last couple of days, a payer negotiations that occurred that's actually being handled very openly and actively on Twitter.
Yeah, so that is interesting. So that's one that, you know, you probably have a little more insight, like, you know, this is coming. You know, so when you're talking about, you know, payer negotiations, I mean, you know when that contract runs out and you know how that's going. You know, another one, and we mentioned, like, you know, the very visible CEO resignation or, you know, that kind of thing. But if you just even think about smaller items, again, if you think about the definition of what a crisis is, and I think it said something about requiring careful attention from management. So you start thinking about, well, I need to pull in leadership into this, right? Mm-hmm. We've seen, you know, folks out there that work at our hospitals make comments online that they should not make. They're racist or inflammatory or whatever it may be. everybody then navigates to that person's, in this case, maybe Facebook page, sees they work at your organization and starts messaging you or calling you out and saying, I can't believe you'd hire somebody like this, you know, one of those type things. So even though those smaller things that, quite honestly, you know, even the local media may not care about, mm-hmm. but you've got to address it. You know, how are you going to handle that?
This can also impact union negotiations, union discussions that you have with your nursing staff or your support staff. And then even with some organizations, and you know, from making business decisions, you're decided to, you know, close up a hospital and now you're just providing ambulatory services in this particular community. I face that a lot when you know, working in a large health system in New York about certain decisions. Any business decision you make has a serious impact on the community, and suddenly that becomes something that, you know, becomes a crisis that needs to be managed.
So those are a lot of great examples. I mean, obviously we could spend a lot of time going on and on about all the things that have happened across the country that involve the hospital getting in, you know, being pulled into the fray, so to speak. And so really, I think maybe we talk a little bit now about the role of digital. Obviously, the news cycle has changed. Mm-hmm. It used to be mass media only. Now it's everybody that has a cell phone kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And so maybe let's talk a little bit about the role of digital on both sides of the coin there, from, you know, reporting the news as well as using it to, you know, actually participate in the communication portion of the crisis management process. And then we'll move into, you know, maybe some tips relative to, you know, what should you go back and look at? What do you need to evaluate? You know, where do you go from here?
You know, what's interesting is now with the rise of mobile and social media, it's really dynamically impacted the way crisis communication occurs. And anybody that does media or crisis communications nowadays does see that, does have the impact. We may be preaching to the choir, but maybe it's just important to reiterate, as the title of this podcast will suggest, right? The 24-hour news cycle has now evolved to 24 seconds. And moreover, anybody can be a reporter now. Anybody can report about what's happening at your organization, which makes it very hard to manage a crisis sometimes.
Yeah, and if it's on social media, it's correct.
Right.
And that's another reason, and that's probably one of the main reasons that you have to be involved, you have to be monitoring, and you have to be participating in that space. Because when a crisis does roll around and something does happen, you know, you need to have that equity in the community, so to speak. Where when you do respond and you do, you know, give updates and things like that, people trust what you're saying.
You know, and I always say I feel sorry for traditional media because they have to go through this vetting cycle and they're caught in this struggle of trying to be quick to, you know, air something, but also have to validate that. And that's why they sometimes are getting that misnomer of being quote unquote fake news, right? Because sometimes they're just moving so fast to catch up with what's already being spoken out there. And it's so hard to manage that.
Yeah, because, you know, your buddy over here, Steve, he doesn't have to vet anything. He can just put it out, you know.
Right.
But if the local news affiliate does that and then it's proven to be, you know, not true, that's a problem. If your buddy does it, everybody's going to rag on him a little bit and nobody's going to know, you know.
Right.
Nobody knows who this guy is. But if he happens to be right, that's how, you know, his Twitter video ends up on like CNN.
So we're not going to get deep into social media and the impact on news reporting. But the other piece of it is I think that digital is in some cases really the best way to reach populations or people, and in particularly in a crisis. You know, I'm hearing about what's happening in Puerto Rico and what's happened in Florida and Texas. And I remember, you know, in a very benign case, when I was at Inova Health in D.C., we had an earthquake, which was kind of unheard of, by the way, for D.C. to get an earthquake, like a 5.0 earthquake.
I had no idea.
Yeah, no one really knew.
Yeah, right? It's like, what was that? Yeah.
So what happened is the minute it occurred, everybody started calling everybody on their phone lines. At the hospital system that we're at, all of the phone lines suddenly became flooded. Because people were calling to see if their loved one was okay. What that did is it actually shut down the phone system. And there was no really structural, there was a little bit of structural damage, but nothing really, nothing, no physical damage occurred. But what happened is no one could reach through to the phone systems because everybody's calling everybody. And this is about, you know, 8 years ago. I took to social media because, quite frankly, Twitter was a great way to get a communication out to certain people, in a, you know, because the phone lines were down. And then I think about what's happening today in these states and territories that we were talking about, and I'm thinking that's probably what happened. You know, a lot of communication through social channels, texting one another, posting updates on Facebook. That's one thing people have with them. It's like, hey, here's a communication. It's a great way for an organization to reach out to these people.
That's really interesting. Man, I'm still just dumbfounded that there's earthquakes in D.C.
Yeah.
It's instantaneous. And so, you know, all the digital properties are. Whereas back in the day, you had to wait for the evening news, like, to get updated. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of a thing. So, yeah, it's interesting.
You know, digital is like a really effective channel. And quite frankly, with digital websites, social media, we've talked about this a lot. But there's a lot of good characteristics around these channels that people in the community imbue on these channels. So, you know, it's a great way to build trust with people. If you're being open and communicative, particularly in a crisis, people will turn to you as a resource. If you are like a hospital reporting about a particular emergency or crisis that's happening at your hospital, depending on how you communicate it, the credibility is gained. You know, you can embrace transparency. You could be very quick. You could provide relevant information. And quite frankly, it allows for people to also respond back to you. And you can actually get into a dialogue as appropriate with people in your community. So really, digital becomes a very effective channel for crisis communications.
So we, you know, I think we've kind of checked the box on why digital. I mean, obviously, people, you know, want to be updated in a timely fashion. And that's the best way to do that and be transparent and quick and all that kind of good stuff. Let's talk a little bit about some of the, as far as the role of digital is concerned, the tools, kind of what's in the toolbox, why are they used? Maybe even, and this bleeds into a little bit of some of the tips, but what do we need to be thinking about relative to these tools as it relates to crisis communications? So, you know, social media, obviously, we've been talking about that. We've talked about Twitter and even Facebook Live, for example, and things like that. So, How does social fit in the toolbox, or what should we be considering as far as its use case?
Well, I think it's really important when you look at social media that you define its role in a crisis as part of your crisis planning. And you could say what we're going to be using in a crisis, we'll be using Twitter for this type of communication. We'll be using Facebook for this type of communication. Maybe we'll be using video on both platforms or whatever it might be. You need to define that clearly and then convey that back to the community in a non-crisis situation and have that as part of part of the community. You'll indicate as a crisis is maybe looming, one that you can actually predict, you can now start to say that we will be using Twitter as a real-time update as to events that are occurring at our facilities through this earthquake or hurricane or, you know, whatever it might be.
You know, a good example of that may be some years ago now, there was a shooting at Fort Hood, which is a military base just north of Austin, kind of between Austin and Waco. When that happened, of course, several of the local hospitals became very engulfed in this. That's where the Scott and White system, which is now Baylor Scott and White, was based. And I know the social media manager there pretty well, and they ended up using, and they had just gotten approval to actually use social media as an organization. So that'll tell you how long ago this was. And they started using Twitter. So as you imagine, when things like this happen, we've talked in previous podcasts about our limited bandwidth as marketing and communication leaders and departments. Well, they're running around crazy, trying to keep everything going and all the stuff that's happening. They're not sitting at their desk. So this was not only a way to keep the media updated about what was going on and what was happening, but then it turned into a way, and that was what they used it for initially, but then it kind of morphed because the community was like, how can we help these victims, right? Mm-hmm. So what they started using Twitter for was actually alerting people of where the shortest wait was to give blood.
Yeah.
So they started directing people around town like, hey, there's no wait over here at this place or that place or, we've got a place out at this parking lot or whatever. And they were able to direct people that were wanting to help and give people a way to be involved.
I think that's a tremendously powerful use of social media to do that. And I remember that what occurred, and they also had a really robust website where they communicated information too. And that's another digital tool, Reed, that we could talk about is websites. How do we use websites in crisis communications? Oftentimes what happens is special web pages get created which are dedicated to just real-time update news. It's almost like a blog, right, where you're creating real-time update news. Sometimes that's created in like sort of the online newsroom. I remember when I was at Northwell and we had blizzards that were coming in. What we actually did is we created a blizzard website that basically was designed where we could, a blog, where we could just do real-time updates about what's going on. You could put in video, you could put in, you know, just little brief snippets. We were able to capture in communication from a variety of different sources as well to put that out there, you know, around like road closures, etc. That becomes really powerful to do. Our main website couldn't handle it because our main website was sort of an older traditional website. So what we did then is on our regular website, we actually, because it was static and a little bit harder to manage, we actually put a little alert banner on the main website that says for updates on the blizzard, go over to this site and link people over to that.
I think that's a good point, and I think that's something that that's a good takeaway for everybody to go back and ask within their organization, because the last thing you want to do, again, when this thing happens, it's not like a lot of people are just sitting around looking for stuff to do, right? So go ahead and determine when we have a crisis or a message that has to get out, what are we going to do? Where does that go? Where do we put it? Because the last thing is like, hey, we got to get something up on the website about Ebola. Okay, great. Where do you want me to put that? And then we end up in this conversation like, we don't want to take down that banner on the homepage. So we say, well, let's move those down. And can we put a thing here? It's like, yeah, so that's one of those things, like figure that out now and say, listen, if we're going to have a crisis, we're going to have one of those little alerts that slides down from the top and we'll be able to fill in some context. And then that will take them to this maybe blog property or page or whatever, you know, dark page that we already have built. And it can do all these things. And so we'll have somewhere to put that content and get everybody to kind of sign off on that now. So when it comes time to do it, you can just do it.
Yeah. And you mentioned the word dark, Reed, right? Dark sites are sometimes created when you don't want that communication to be muddling into your major brand in terms of like some internal factors. You know, this might be a particular crisis you're trying to manage. And what you could do is you can create a site that's only used as a targeted purpose around particular crisis communications, maybe in a proactive way instead of a reactive way. What you're doing is you're pushing out specific communication around this crisis to targeted audiences. And that happens a lot around payer negotiations. We mentioned the one that's happening right now on Twitter, and we'll link to, you know, some information around that so people can be aware of that. But what's interesting is they created a particular website around this that had specific unique talking points to support that particular crisis.
Yeah, both sides did. The payer side and the hospital side both have a landing page with a custom URL and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So anyway, great. And we'll link to that. Email blast. I mean, obviously, for those that have a CRM or just have maybe an affinity group of some sort, et cetera, you know, have a bunch of emails for whatever reason, you know, that's a different way that you can obviously communicate out and drive to these things that we're talking about. Like, hey, for real-time updates, follow us here. For more information about, you know, you send to those dark sites or landing pages.
And tied to that really closely is also SMS and text messaging. If you have that information about those particular affinity groups, where I see this happen a lot, Reed, is where when you want to communicate messages out to your employees, particularly in a crisis time, to get bullet points out to them and say, these are the talking points, this is where you want to direct people. Your employees become a big part of the communication process, but you can't train them all to become crisis experts, crisis communication experts. So, you know, you could send them a blast to say, hey, our facility is down because of the blizzard, or hey, if anybody asks you about this particular thing, go to this website where it has the talking points, or even just direct them to this website. That's a really good way to communicate. Email and SMS is starting to get out to more of the public now, communication outwards to the public. But, you know, again, that's really tricky, particularly in the type of crisis, how you want to manage that.
All this to say, it's like, obviously, there's different, you know, kind of customized solutions where you can have online newsrooms, video releases, etc. But all going back to the idea that These are what we've talked about to this point is pushing out messaging. It's really important, obviously, to have the monitoring listening tools in place that you can, you know, hear what else is going on and potentially even find out about some of these things before they become a crisis.
Yeah, that happens quite a lot, where you can track maybe the health outbreaks. I know Google has spent a lot of time trying to understand if there's a potential like health outbreak that's occurring and starting to tap into that sort of those monitoring, listening, and even predictive ways of understanding where crises may occur. That becomes a really critical part of your PR and your crisis communications from a digital perspective. So Reid, we talked about some of the tools. I think the tools are only as good as the tools until you embrace internal strategies. So yeah. Why don't we talk a little bit about ways organizations are embracing some internal strategies to kind of communicate or to handle a crisis?
So most, if not all, hospitals have a crisis communications plan and team with actual roles and things like that. I would assume your marketing or if you have a specific or called out communications lead within your organization, that they will probably, you know, 99 times out of 100, be the PIO, the public information officer, in those cases. Most people have disaster preparedness drills that they do annually, even stuff like baby abductions and, you know, all those types of drills that you do. When we're looking at those plans, it's really important at this point, I think, to go back, understand how digital fits in that, maybe even work with your folks within the organization to work in some of those things. So again, you've got the ability to spend some time working through these things and answering these, getting these questions answered, surfaced and answered in more of a drill or training exercise versus, you know, when it happens for real, it being the first time anybody's thought about something.
It takes me back to when I was working at Inova. I was asked to participate in a crisis communication team. And this team was a multi-hospital team. So imagine all of our competitors in the market tying in with the emergency response teams. This is in DC. Clearly, they had a very established protocol around how to respond in communication. But at the time, they really were struggling to really understand the power of how social media can fit in this. And so bringing in your experts around how to communicate in social media, how to use these different channels, what these channels are used for, that becomes really critical to have that person on your team, particularly for crisis communication. So I was even in those rooms, you know, you've seen those rooms where everybody puts on the little vests, you know, the little orange vests or whatever, and they all sit around a table together. And I had a little vest, and on the back of it, it said social media. And I thought it was pretty cool, right? But I mean, you know, This was many years ago, but still, the point is, though, is be part of that. Make sure that you're proactively part of that and contributing good practices. And as a digital expert, you can bring a lot to the table because there may be some tools or channels that they're overlooking.
Absolutely. And I think some of that is even internal training. So sure, everybody involved in leadership roles needs to understand the role of digital in these situations, but also the staff. So hey guys, I know everybody here has a Twitter account and Facebook account and this, that, and the other. You cannot post, you know, or whatever. You know, you need to go through with what the expectation is for them as individuals, as employees, on their personal properties, and where they can find information and what is okay for them to share, not share. Mm-hmm. You know, how HIPAA still applies within this particular, even though maybe it's commonly known around the community or something at this point, and people are reporting on things, what that means or doesn't mean about what they can then say.
And the trick here too is because digital channels are changing so frequently, you want to make sure that you're not only just there when the crisis occurs, but you're proactively also providing updates and maybe bringing new ideas to the table when you're looking at new ways to communicate. Now, in many organizations, employees might be communicating to one another through, you know, separate digital channels. It could be like an intranet or it could be whatever, you know, and the crisis team may or may not be aware of that. Again, as being the digital lead or the person that's kind of looking at where digital is going, you could bring a lot to that table. What is the role of, let's say, Snapchat in the future, right? If there is, right? Or what is the role of, you know, whatever voice recognition or voice first technology in the future? You know, these are things that we can actually kind of proactively bring to help improve our communications.
Hey, Chris, before we go too much further, jump into this next segment of the podcast, I did want to mention and thank one of our sponsors, Influence Health. You know, they've got a consumer experience platform that covers several things. And correct me if I'm wrong, but we've talked about content management systems on this podcast.
Yeah, we did.
What about CRMs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we covered CRMs for sure.
And then obviously each and every week we talk about digital marketing. So digital marketing systems, you know, in one way, shape or form have probably been covered, right?
That's right. Digital marketing systems. And I would say that we even talk about it in a way of that overall digital consumer experience.
Well, there you go. I would recommend for anybody interested in one of those topics or anything else, they've also got some complimentary solutions on their website. But head over to their website, take a look at what they've got and what they're offering relative to CMS, CRM, digital marketing systems, kind of how all that is woven together in what they call their consumer experience platform. Find your way over to influencehealth.com. You know, that gives a pretty good context, pretty good layout for the role of digital, both from everyone's now a reporter to how we use these tools to how it's, you know, kind of changed a little bit how we've thought about disaster preparedness to this point, or crisis communications to this point. And so, you know, maybe let's look a little bit at, okay, so now what do you do? So we've talked about some recommendations in here. We've dropped a few things here and there around training employees or, you know, getting with your director of facilities or whoever runs the different drills and making sure social's a part of that, et cetera. But what else should we be considering or looking at as we move forward?
Maybe what we could do is kind of turn towards an article by our good friend Jay Bearer. You remember Jay, right?
Absolutely.
He created a really good presentation about this, about crisis communications, that kind of gives a framework. And maybe we could use that framework as a way to kind of talk about some other, you know, maybe ideas that we haven't covered yet. So one of the first things he does is he kind of says, well, there's three things you really need to, or a couple of things you need to do before you actually could start managing that crisis. First of all, he strongly recommends to keep those social media monitoring or listening tools in place and be proactive about managing your brand and your communication, even well before a crisis may occur. And Reed, we've worked with a couple of those social media monitoring listening tools.
I do want to say this, because there are a lot of hospitals out there that don't see a lot of value in those tools because not a lot happens in their community. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's a pretty boring feed. So you're not in a huge market, you know, there's not a ton of things happening. But as you'll hear from Lance here in just a little bit, you know, a story that happened, boy, we're coming on 30 years here pretty quick, which was baby Jessica, for those that remember, the little baby that fell in the well in West Texas. And again, we'll hear more from Lance on that. That's not a big community either. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's actually a pretty small town. And so there's not a lot to see and not a lot to hear on some of these. But again, if you don't have them in place, it's really hard to come back and add that in the middle of a crisis to try to figure out what's going on if you don't already have it in place.
That's so true. And, you know, you can use some free tools. You could use some paid tools that are out there to do social listening. It's really what works best for your particular situation or your particular environment. The larger the organization, I find they invest more in social media listening tools, which is, I think it makes sense. The other thing too I found, Reed, is that developing that who is listening, that protocol about who is listening. Because quite frankly, you know, there's nothing more difficult than when you're in the midst of a crisis and you're trying to manage something and you're part of the official communication team, suddenly the CEO sends an email over to you and says, I just heard this out here. You know, what are you going to be doing about it? And suddenly it becomes another, like a fire within the fire. Having an established protocol around who's listening to what and what their role is, who's going to be communicating, again, very important, very important.
And then ultimately, we mentioned this before, but define what is and isn't a crisis. Wikipedia definition, you know, a crisis is something that requires, you know, basically management to get involved. Mm-hmm. So that falls in a number of things. It could be something that an employee did or said online. It could be a natural disaster, you know, or any of the things that we've talked about. But I think there's probably some different ways, you know, there's different tiers, if you will. And so kind of defining that out and understanding, again, like we just talked about, who's listening and who's going to respond, who's the point person.
Well, and Jay defines the three characteristics of a crisis that is one that you need to respond to or that you should respond to. And it might be interesting to just talk about them. The first is information asymmetry. Information asymmetry. And what that means is that maybe there's a lot of communication going on in the community and your organization is not part of it. And it's related to your organization. Well, you know, so suddenly you have this imbalance.
Yeah, if you find a Facebook group online that it's like, you know, concerned citizens against in your hospital name, like that's probably a good thing to take note of and fits within that. So, yeah, that's a good one. And then, you know, anything that you see like a decisive or a real noticeable change, you know, from the norm.
Anytime communication about your organization is a lot different than what you're actually doing from a PR perspective, from a branding perspective, it could be about a particular individual doctor, a doctor that may have said something, you know, offensive on TV, or it could be, you know, again, back to the union negotiations. If what's starting to be talked about is a lot different than what you feel the branding and the messaging of your organization should be, that's a decisive change from the norm. And that could be a flag for you to suddenly say, okay, we need to be at least monitoring this, if not responding to this accordingly.
And then the final one being, you know, that there's some sort of a, you know, material impact on your business. You know, that can mean a number. That can mean a number of different things. That's not getting your feelings hurt. So again, somebody saying like this doctor is terrible, the doctor's not going to love that and he's going to want something done about it. But it's not really a crisis, you know, per se. And so, but, you know, there are things that happen, again, natural disasters, otherwise, you know, school shootings. We've seen some of those here in recent weeks and months, or of course, recent years. It's a little bit different. And then things that are physically happening at your hospital, obviously, you know, continue to have that more, you know, I guess, solidified impact.
That's a good list. And we'll link to Jay Baer's, it's a presentation and a blog post that's out there. And I'm sure that others may have some examples that they want to share with us. We would welcome you to let us know, send in your tips, other things that you may learn. And when we'll hear from Lance later, we'll hear how some of the work that he's been doing with crisis communications. But so I hope that was an exhaustive primer on digital and PR, crisis communication. Hey, we want to take a moment to thank one of our sponsors, and that's our good friends at Binary Fountain.
You know, as a healthcare marketer, it's probably pretty obvious these days how much time you're spending on reviews, ratings relative to hospitals, physicians, all that kind of good stuff. You know, too many of those are going unanswered, and they're certainly not being analyzed.
This could be costing us new and current customers. It could be impacting our patient experience scores and potentially impacting our revenue. Luckily, our good friends at Binary Fountain have an online reputation management platform called Binary Health Analytics.
If you'd like to learn more or even schedule a demo, visit them online at binaryfountain.com. That's binaryfountain.com.
Touch counterpoint. There are two sides to every story. Ready, fight! All right, now we're going to get into a little particular nuanced topic around crisis communications. And it's one that I've said before, it's a line I've said before, Reed, when I was presenting about crisis communications in the past with social media. I said the line, social media shouldn't force us to be transparent. We should force ourselves to be transparent. And what I mean by that is, a lot of times when you're in a crisis communication mode, you want to shape the message. My belief system is social media is like sort of the, you know, casting light against the whole situation. And if something comes up in social media to respond to, we should embrace that positively and encourage that communication online, not try to shelter it and guide it to dark sites or to these other places. So I believe that we should be transparent, you know, as an orientation from a crisis communications perspective.
So yes. However, I think in healthcare, it's really hard to nuance that via social. And I think you have to use some of these other tools, like some dark sites or landing pages, videos or whatever, to really tell your story. Because otherwise, you know, now you're allowing social media to take you for a ride versus, you know, trying to communicate and convey actual facts.
Well, don't get me wrong. I'm okay with, you know, communicating and our particular positions and guiding the message and trying to set the tone in our position. But I guess my point here is, even if we're going to get outside opinions or outside thoughts, we should welcome that. We should look at those organizations and those other, you know, community members on social media and even on other platforms as a way for us to dialogue with them. And we should embrace that dialogue.
Sure. I think that is great in an idealistic or utopian sense, but I just don't feel like we've got people running social media channels, in all cases at least, running social media channels that we can trust to do that. And so now we've got to pull somebody else from a leadership perspective in to be, you know, sitting there tweeting or, you know, running, you know, Facebook accounts that are going to be doing other things. I don't think we can have those conversations safely yet until social media becomes, you know, a bigger deal for organizations.
I don't know. I disagree with you. I think that in some cases, we remember very clearly about that the CEO of, well, now I don't remember it very clearly, but the CEO of a hospital system in Boston who was very transparent and he ran his own blog.
Oh, yeah. Paul Levy.
Paul Levy, right.
Isn't that right?
Yeah, exactly. Paul Levy. And then, of course, he underwent a scandal himself. And he was very transparent through the whole scandal about what happened. And he acknowledged his mistakes. He resigned. And he kept blogging even after that. You know, from my perspective, I think in some cases it's important for a CEO or a clinician or the chief medical officer to be on those social channels.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's okay. I just don't think that is realistically going to happen at this point. I'm sure you can find examples of it, but I just don't think that's an occurrence that's commonly going to happen or can even be planned for in most organizations.
Yeah, and I think maybe this is now what we're trying to do, and this may be a very short segment today because we're starting to kind of come into the middle, because as I talk about this, I realize that social media has given rise for a lot of voices to be talking on about different things, and everybody has an individual, unique position on social media. Mm-hmm. Do we have the bandwidth to respond to everybody on social media? I'm starting to wonder. Maybe I'm starting to get to the middle now. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard just because of a pure bandwidth standpoint. I think that's a tough deal. I think that's a tough deal. It's going to be hard to see that through in a lot of cases.
I still think we should be positioning ourselves as being transparent first and lead with transparency and don't think that we can hide things anymore and being able to communicate. But sometimes when you're communicating messaging, as we've learned over the last couple of years, sometimes mm-hmm. one message resonates differently with different people. And so that becomes a little bit of a challenge.
I think we'll see it continue to mature. I mean, we're not Southwest Airlines. We're not, you know, a lot of those types of organizations that have relied on these type of communications for a long time. It's still relatively new. And I know people don't like to hear that and are tired of hearing about that hospitals are, you know, behind the curve and this, that, and the other. But it's reality in a lot of cases.
And what with, you know, how we have to protect HIPAA, we have to protect patient information. We want to make sure that as we're communicating very carefully because we do not want mm-hmm. to inadvertently put a person's health information at risk.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I guess I caved a little early on that conversation or in that argument, Reed.
Again, it's, you know, utopia versus reality, and it's somewhere we need to be, but you know, just can't get there quite yet, at least in all cases. All right, we're back with our expert interview portion of the podcast, and with today's topic around crisis communications and how that relates to digital Thought of no one better to visit with than our guest today, Lance Lunsford. Lance is the communications and marketing lead or leader at the Texas Hospital Association. So you can track them down online, and we'll have some links in the show notes and obviously how to find Lance. We'll talk a little bit more about that here in a minute. Thanks for spending a few minutes with us.
Yeah, thanks, man.
So wanted to talk a little bit about crisis communications, specifically as it relates to, you know, kind of the digital world. But you've got an interesting point of view, and it all revolves around a book you wrote some years ago. So tell us a little bit about the book and kind of why we're talking about this right now.
Yeah, thanks. And you know, I do get to see just the entire state and really the entire country and the hospitals that have to really move rather quickly when it comes to putting messaging out when a crisis does occur. And those are crises, whether it's storms that are coming or someone in a facility that's made a mistake of one sort or another. But yeah, I mean, what we've dealt with in crisis communications isn't new, obviously. It's not even new for the 24-hour news medium. But when I was a newspaper reporter, I started out my career as a newspaper reporter in my hometown of Midland, Texas, which is home to the Jessica McClure rescue that we had all come to know as this little girl, as baby Jessica.
Yeah, baby Jessica in the well. Right. Yeah, absolutely.
So it's October. It's 1987. And there is an off the wow. books, unlicensed home daycare that's being run with a number of children. And the mother of Jessica McClure turns her back for a minute to go inside to answer a telephone. And she comes back outside, and the children are gathered around this well head. Now, again, I think when a lot of people picture it, and I know I did because I was a child, I was in the fourth grade when this occurred. I think everybody pictures the large wishing well that they've seen in fairy tales. But
there's like a little winch and the little bucket. Roof and the bucket, sure. And you throw pennies in there and stuff. Yeah, yeah,
exactly. And I think that everybody pictured that.
Yep.
When the call went out to law enforcement, there was actually a call for a girl stuck in a pipe, as many of the first responders recall hearing it. When the first responders actually got there, they found a pipe coming out of the ground at about 4 or 5 inches, sticking out of the surface. This isn't normal. It's not like these are around every part of West Texas, but you know, if you've been around, you know that a lot of these were uncapped. They weren't welded shut. It would just be a pipe in the ground. And again, a little small for a child to just easily fit down. But as that occurred, the first one to really hear it, besides law enforcement, were of course then media. They're monitoring the whole time, yeah. Any of the airwaves, and so.
In 1987, so obviously there's no internet at that point, and also there's no cell phones.
One of the first media to actually arrive, I believe, is a TV station, but soon thereafter is a guy named Patrick Crimmins from the Midland Reporter-Telegram. And to your point, I mean, at the time, you have the recent emergence of local news affiliates that are running live television. Mm-hmm. They've got those live capabilities. One of the interesting things about that is that newspaper at the time is an afternoon daily. So that newspaper actually has to get turned in around the time that he got the call. So Patrick had actually been wrapping up his day's story. He was just going to check it out to be like, I'm sure a girl said,
what's this about? Yeah. Yeah, probably be over by the time I get there, kind of a thing. Yeah.
Exactly. So he gets on the scene and realizes, ooh, I've got to get a new filing in. So he literally takes down as few notes as he can because he knows his deadline is like 10 a.m. so that they can get the copy turned in.
Right.
The print press is running by noon. And then that paper's really got to be hitting driveways by 4:30 or 5. That afternoon, people get home, read the evening paper.
Mm-hmm.
He actually wrote his notes down, got his story, went to a local mall and used a landline and called in his story to the city desk.
Wow.
And they type it in and
that's crazy.
Across the wire.
You know, one thing that's kind of interesting is you're talking about crisis communications and the way this happened is, you know, how would that be different now?
Yeah.
Right. And so you see things that happen in the local media, and you know, typically the way I find out about it is I'm scrolling through Facebook or something like that. I'm not going to a news station's website, which obviously didn't exist back then. And so we've seen this progression.
Mm-hmm. Especially when you consider the kind of access that individuals had. So again, I should reiterate a couple of things. One, I was in the fourth grade at the time. My mm-hmm. school was actually about a mile away. So you could hear the sirens, and they were loud and they were nonstop. And for some reason, that always really stuck out in my mind in recalling this. The other thing about this is that you've actually got neighbors. I mean, this is someone's backyard. So picture your backyard. You have an alley. Now people can come into your backyard. They can look over the fence. Now add cell phones to that.
Right.
Now add Facebook Live. At the time, there was no kind of national formalized adoption of a command center to manage like an emergency scene. Mm-hmm. So there was no one to manage media on site. So there was, and then there was no public entity. There was no like electric company. It wasn't at a hospital. So so when media started arriving, they either like walked up to the well where the police were and first responders were like standing over it and with their ear up to it, trying to listen whether they could hear a sound from the baby coming out of the well, or they were in from behind the fence. So initially, and we've got some images of it, you've got TV cameras like right there on top of the well.
Yeah.
Eventually they were moved a couple of feet away to from behind a fence. Of course, by the end of that day, I mean, you've got that day one, you've got live feed from the scene from the KMID, the local ABC affiliate. But into the next day, you have an onslaught of national media starting to pour in.
That's interesting to think about. Obviously, if you're at a hospital, maybe you are somebody in the marketing communications department is the public information officer. So there's kind of a protocol for a lot of this. But, you know, how does social and digital like change that? Because everybody's a reporter now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so that is one of the most interesting things about what I uncovered in this story was when you get about halfway into the second day, and remember this took 58 total hours. So at hour 24, they thought that they were pretty close to reaching her. That wasn't even the halfway point. So the desperation for angles and news story angles really started to kind of get stretched. I mean, you had people from, I remember there was a Hawaii newspaper that I covered that actually had a reporter there. Dallas Morning News, of course, but then the Boston Globe is there. Every national and international major outlet is there because at the time, they could afford a news corps that level to cover international.
Well, and I guess just the saturation of news wasn't the same either. So you went wherever there was a story versus there were probably other things that were happening in Boston, but you just didn't know. Like, you just didn't know they were happening.
Right, yeah. Right? So something just as tragic could have been occurring, but there are certain elements to this story that made it, like, number one, you've got a baby that you can actually hear. And you can actually hear her voice coming from down the well. And that's all of the elements for individuals being news. Everybody's a reporter. We're there at the time. I mean, the news organizations themselves, they actually had to use their wired mic. They actually dropped the wired mic down the well to see if they could hear her, to capture her voice at all. And then they monitored via their equipment. And could hear her. So the fact that they could hear this child, not reach her, not see her, put a kind of mystery together that made this an appealing story. But the management side of this is what is difficult. So imagine in in hour 25, 26, as reporters are coming to you as the chief communications officer of your hospital, still looking for angles, and you having to service these questions that you've asked, that have been asked and answered 1,000 times, they then stop utilizing you, and they start going into the community and getting their angles. I mean, how many times did you interact with Sissy McClure, the mom? How many times did you know these people? Blah, you know, it was constant. And then this barrage of police officers and EMS guys that if you could get grabbed in the alleyway to provide, hey, what's the latest update? Because you're covered in dust because you've been drilling below ground. they're going to ask you a bunch of questions, and you can't control that as a media manager. Yeah.
I remember when I was actually at a hospital, you know, you do these disaster drills, which usually accounted for me carrying a few sheets of paper around, because those sheets of paper were the reporters. It was like, hey, take these sheets of paper down to the where we hold the media. But you never actually think this is going to happen. Like, would the odds of a train crashing in this town with, you know, biohazard material.
Yeah, you may not be that hospital that has Ebola that comes on board, but the second that you haven't prepared for it, people are going to know.
Right. As we're standing around in hospitals, you know, we've always taken the case, you know, everybody likes to lean on HIPAA or privacy type stuff. They can't talk about a lot of things. But when something big enough happens, you mentioned Ebola, and that's a great example because it happened here in Texas couple of years ago now, or whenever that was. You know, how do you prepare for that? What do you need to make sure you have in place, especially specific to digital, right? Because everybody's got a phone, everybody's wandering around. It's not like, hey, everybody leave your video cameras at the door kind of a thing.
Yeah, I mean, we do live in a world where you have to be careful not to take yourself too seriously, because you can kind of come off as a quack. But in this particular scenario, and if you really put yourself in the position of maybe a THR, where you have to manage the world's media attention with an Ebola crisis or in something lower key, like a train crash that does have a chemical spill that attracts at least regional or statewide media, you have the responsibility as an executive and the chief kind of messaging officer for your hospital to have that preparation in place. And it doesn't have to be something that's outlandish. Again, remember, Midland at that time is a population of just about 100,000, which is a small town. It was one of the larger in West Texas. You do have Lubbock and Odessa that are of similar size, and Abilene, of course. But if it's hard to imagine something of this scale happening in your town, imagine that. I mean, the likelihood, yes, of a little girl falling in a well is hard to imagine, but it should be easy now because, as you say, you know, there is so much access to news and information. Yeah. It's made the world much smaller. So the potential for a somewhat small thing to explode into a big thing is very real. And so having that preparation is going to be important, but you have to have your whole team on board, I think, to realize, like, hey, I know you're our web guy, but imagine being in this scenario. Now you really have to think like a news guy. And if you haven't unentrenched your team from whatever their siloed kind of role is inside the organization, and maybe that's self-described for them, you have to help them to imagine the enormity of what's going to occur. And they're going to have to start thinking not like a reporter to behave like a reporter, but to think like a reporter so as to protect your hospital's brand.
Yeah, and in the absence of information, they're going to make something up, right? And I'm talking about the general public or the media or whoever. So you're going to have to update and inform to some degree as best you can, making sure you have some of the technology in place to provide the messaging. But what else should people be looking at and kind of preparing for?
Well, I think to your point, I think it's empowerment of those team members. Make them really visualize what their role is going to be, and that they will have some autonomy in that environment. As a communications leader, you're not going to be able to control every single thing that comes at you. We've had a number of large-scale incidents that have occurred in Texas, you know, in the last several years. The first two that come to mind, of course, is the recent one with Hurricane Harvey, and watching all of our hospitals really respond to that. Of course, they had the benefit of a well-prepared emergency response apparatus, not only with their own hospitals, but then also with the regional advisory committee councils that responded really well. And so they didn't have the kind of Katrina-type communications nightmare that they could have had, but again, there was, you could see the preparation in place. But the other one, it would be the West explosion, the chemical plant explosion, and that was, you know, Waco. And so you have another medium-sized town. It's major for where it sits on the map. Again, it may not be major in scale for what its reputation is in the worldwide community. It's not in New York City or Chicago or anything that. But nevertheless, the onslaught of the media attention was pretty significant for the two major hospitals in that area. So both of those communications teams resulted in an on-hands-deck kind of situation. So while your team has to have that kind of centralized command and understanding, you also have to provide for your larger hospital team the roles and responsibility that they have to cycle the communications to you and they have to understand that. So they have to have a certain level of training and a certain level of understanding what their responsibility mm-hmm. is in that situation. Realize it's not just a matter of, cordoning off the hospital and saying no media here. As a matter of fact, right. that kind of lack of transparency does damage to your hospital yeah. brand. In that moment, you really want to show, you want your hospital employees to really feel like they have some responsibility in showing your hospital's willingness to be transparent, but ultimately that it's your role in protecting that HIPAA compliance.
All hospitals do these disaster trainings. Have we worked social media and digital into those scenarios?
Point. I don't think they have completely visualized that. Again, you can't stop the flow of information. And mm-hmm. I think one of the first knee-jerk reactions that especially a lot of people that don't have control over the yep. social media channels have, their knee-jerk reaction is shut it down. Close it down. Yeah. I can't exactly call yeah. Zuckerberg and tell him to close down Facebook
yeah, for exactly.
Local hospital A, B, or C. But that also will end up doing exponential damage when it basically broadcasts to your entire community that you have a fear of transparency.
Yeah.
And so the big opportunity that I would highlight is the way Texas Health Resources responded during Ebola. They had already a culture of transparency in a lot of their quality and patient safety initiatives. In their desire to be transparent, I think really is one of the things that allowed them to rebound so quickly after mm-hmm. the Ebola incident. And again, there were some things that occurred because of that transparency that had gotten out inaccurately, but it all kind of occurred because of that desire to be transparent with the public. But again, I think that it allowed them to recover quickly because they were putting that messaging out into their various channels. They did it in a meaningful way.
How are we messaging to our own staff and employees what to say or not to say or how to help?
I think it's important for you to weigh in your response what it is the media is trying to accomplish in their telling of the story. I mean, we had a couple of reporters. We had a reporter in Lubbock who kind of gained access, backdoor access to a hospital in a restricted area to talk to a patient. That patient access had been managed. I mean, they were going to get access to that patient to have that conversation.
Right.
But it was a somewhat sensitive thing at the time. Reporters, again, make some questionable judgment, but they're not all, the Pulitzer-seeking freak show reporter that was right. a diehard. Some right. of them, they are altruistically driven to do a good job, and we depend on them to provide that information. And if you look at each of those interactions you're having with a reporter to help them accomplish that goal, you are definitely going to achieve a good reputation outcome in
yeah.
how you present your brand. I don't think enough communications folks, like the FLAC managers, really realize that that's the approach to take.
So this is the 30th anniversary of baby Jessica. For those that don't know the story, you could probably find out pretty quickly by Googling baby Jessica. But the book.
Yeah.
How do people find the book?
So it's, yeah, thank you. It's on Amazon. You can go to therainbowsshadow.com, and that'll be updated with the latest, the third edition. We chronicle the rescue, but more importantly, I think the aftermath and the tragedies that occurred that no one really in Midland wanted to talk too much about.
And then you can find Lance online at Lance Lunsford on Twitter, and we'll have links to all that good stuff, THA and otherwise, in the show notes. But thanks for joining us, and we'll have you back on soon.
Thanks, Reed. The podcast is great.
All right, here we are, the end of episode 34. So we are, we've been doing this for a while now. this was great. So Crisis Communications, and you even got to hear a little something about baby Jessica. So that was fun. HCIC is coming up, Healthcare Internet Conference. Of course, we'll be there October 23rd through the 25th. Come say hi. We'll be live and on stage on Tuesday afternoon, so keep an eye out for that. If you have not registered, hcic.net for more information there. And we'll wrap up with a couple recommendations. What do you got?
I'm going to recommend a book today, Reed. And it's a book that actually is not out yet, but I have an advanced copy.
Oh boy.
Yes. Some of you may know that I actually work with a professional coach. My professional coach, her name is Camille Preston, and I've been working with her for a number of years. And she is also not only a leadership coach, and she works on, you know, workplace productivity, et cetera. She is actually a specialist around how to be an effective leader and an effective employee in an overwired world, in a world now where we have so many distractions. And she just recently came out with a book that I actually kind of read. I got an advanced copy because I know her. And it's called Create More Flow, Igniting Peak Performance in an Overwired World. I will put a link in our show notes today so you can get an advanced copy of this book. You can get an ebook version or a hard copy book. I just happen to have the hard copy here. But the whole point here is, this book is really means a lot to me because I'm one of those persons that I'm constantly distracted and I'm constantly doing multiple things at once while I'm working. And this, you know, it just happens. And the more I work with her and the more I learn about some of this, you know, the ways that you can hack your flow, so to speak, and use your productivity in a way that actually can make you an effective leader, it's really powerful. So I love the book, Create More Flow by Camille Preston. And again, I'll put a link to pre-order advanced copies on Amazon in our show notes. It'll come out in October.
There you go. Very cool. I too am recommending a book, strangely enough, which many people may have read, but I'm recommending a specific version of it. So The Clue Train Manifesto. Have you read this book?
I've heard of it. I have not read it.
Yeah, it's really good. So it originally, the initial one came out in 1999. Well, I guess in this would have been in 2009. This is the 10th anniversary edition. There's some additional pieces to this, which include some internet experts, one of which is a friend of mine, a guy named Jake McKee. That's here in Austin, and maybe we'll have him on the podcast eventually. But the original one proclaimed an end to business as usual. Well, this particular one, you know, they walk through the reality of the networked marketplace, and one of their theses, the initial one at least, is around the simplicity and the truth of that markets are conversations. Mm-hmm. And so I think this applies to a lot of the things that we've talked about over the different episodes. But anyway, it's a great read and a lot of good insights in there, even though it is some years old at this point. But anyway, The Clue Train Manifesto, and we'll have a link to that as well.
Awesome.
Head over to iTunes, subscribe, rate, and review us, and connect with us online and let us know how we're doing. We appreciate all the support, and of course our sponsors have been wonderful. Look forward to seeing you all at HCIC and talking to you next week. He is Chris Boyer. I'm Reed Smith. Have a good week.